And we welcome back, and we're grateful for it, Alan Blackman, Professor of Chemistry, School of Science, Auckland University of Technology. Hello again, Alan.
Hi, Catherine.
Now, we love these amazing things happening, and we get a bit lost sometimes. You get your black hole confused with your... I've forgotten the other one already.
White dwarf.
Exactly.
Maybe, yeah.
It's been a while since we've looked this far up to the stars. What are the anti-stars?
Yeah, well, this is kind of interesting. So this is a paper that has been published very recently looking at the possible existence of these things called anti-stars. And in order to describe what an anti-star is, we need to delve into the world of matter and antimatter. And as I always tell my first year chemistry students, matter is anything that takes up space, essentially. And antimatter is kind of its mirror image, if you want to call it that. So if we talk about the simple atom, we think of atoms being made up of protons and electrons and neutrons. We can make antimatter as well. And antimatter is composed of things called positrons, which are positively charged electrons, which is really weird, and antiprotons, which are negatively charged protons, and antineutrons, which are made up of things called antiquarks. And you can construct atoms out of antimatter in the same way that you can construct atoms out of matter.
Now, does it behave differently?
Well, when antimatter meets matter, then literally all hell breaks loose.
One can imagine. But if you have an anti-atom, say, what does an anti-atom do?
When an anti-atom meets a normal atom, then they annihilate each other and they give out things called gamma rays. And I don't know if you've ever been unfortunate enough to go to a hospital and get a PET scan, but PET scans are positron emission tomography, and they actually involve antimatter. So these little things called positrons are emitted by some radioactive nuclei, and they allow you to get an image of the inside of your body, essentially, if you do it correctly. So, yeah, antimatter and matter, they certainly don't like each other. And the current theory is that when the universe was bursted, I guess, into being in the Big Bang, that equal amounts of both matter and antimatter were formed. And one of the big questions in science now is where the hell is all of the antimatter gone? Because the universe appears to be made mostly of matter. But there should be lots of antimatter out there.
Well, is that where our black holes and our black matter are relevant? No, that's just because we can't see them, isn't it?
Well, that's the reason for that. You certainly can't see them. But these folks in France who have done basically a survey of 10 years of observations of a thing called the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope that's busy going around the Earth above our heads, they have found possibly 14 light sources out there in the universe that are emitting gamma rays that could very well have come from a matter-antimatter type of interaction. And so their proposal is that these stars, these points of light, could very, very well be anti-stars. In other words, stars that are actually made of antimatter.
Are they likely to be, as stars are, very, very, very old?
Well, presumably, you know, everything is pretty old if, you know, everything came from the Big Bang, essentially. So, but what they think is going on is these antimatter stars are coming into contact with matter and they're giving out these gamma rays. These gamma rays are being detected here on Earth, gazillions of light years away from wherever. But what they're thinking is that, okay, this could be some of the missing antimatter that should be there according to our current theories of the origins of the universe.
So is it possible that it's there but we have not had the right or powerful enough gear to see it before now?
Yeah, well, certainly this this gamma ray space telescope is designed basically to detect gamma rays.
And so look for the right stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what you're looking for. And so they've made some sort of back-of-the-envelope calculations, these guys in France, and they reckon anything from 1 in 10 to about 1 in 400,000 of the stars that we can see might very well be anti-stars. They would look the same to us. They'd behave the same as a normal star. They'd emit light, et cetera, et cetera. It's just that they're made of antimatter. So
interesting.
Yeah, kind of cool.
All right, let's talk now about, honestly, if you've ever had a bad tramp, set off on an expedition and it went wrong, this in history is probably one of the most famous, isn't it? And what has vitamin A got to do with it?
Well, today's the 5th of May, and I chose this story because Sir Douglas Mawson was born on the 5th of May in 1882. And his is a story that possibly should, in fact, be better known, I think. Our great Sir Edmund Hillary said that Mawson's experience was probably the greatest story of lone survival in polar exploration. And, yeah, we're going to get to vitamin A, but first, obviously, a little bit of background here. So Mawson and two of his companions, Belgrave Ninnis and Javier Mertz, were in Antarctica in 1912, and they were mapping out Antarctica in the days before, you know, Antarctica was known. And they set off on the 10th of November as a three-person expedition. And coincidentally, the 10th of November was 2 days before the bodies of Scott and his party were actually found, Scott Wilson and Bowers. And so all went well for the first month of this expedition. They were out there mapping the coastline of Antarctica. And then, unfortunately, they had two sleds with them. Most of the food, all of the dog food and most of the human food was on one sled. And unfortunately, that one went through a crevasse along with Belgrave Ninnis and six of the best dogs who were hauling these sleds. So poor old Mawson and Mertz found themselves 507 kilometres away from the hut with certainly not a lot of food left, and they were pretty much all alone. So they realised they had to turn around and try and get back to base. And in doing that, they had to subsist on around about 400 grams of food each day. And that went on for 23 days until, unfortunately, Mertz died. Because most of their food went down with a sled, they then had to kill the six remaining dogs that they had to feed both themselves and the dogs as well. So they were killing the dogs one by one. Mertz was a vegetarian, unfortunately, so he wasn't used to meat. And what happens was that Mertz, from the 1st of January, went downhill very, very fast. And he displayed horrible symptoms, absolutely horrible. So constant dysentery. He lost his hair. Both of them lost all of the skin off their legs and their genitals. And that's probably as painful as it sounds. Mertz had fits, delirium. He was raving. And eventually he died on January the 8th. And then Mawson, in the great survival story, then cut the sledge in half with a pocket knife, for goodness sake, and he started walking back to civilization. He found that his feet hurt. He had a look at them. The soles of his feet were peeling off. So he sort of lashed them on and covered them with lanolin, and he eventually, long story short, made it back to civilization, weighing 51 kilograms when normally he weighed 95. So the big question is, why did Mertz die, and what was going on here? And one of the proposals is that it was due to an overabundance of vitamin A, and that can be toxic. And vitamin A is stored in dogs' liver, in the liver, and so dogs' livers had a very, very high concentration of vitamin A. And that's the sort of the current thinking anyway, is that Mertz passed away. All his symptoms were classic vitamin A poisoning. So it's an amazing story, really and honestly. If you haven't heard it, go and read a book about it, because it's absolutely compelling.
Wonderful.
Absolutely incredible story of survival.
Terrible at the same time. Very quickly, what's the story with the froth on the top of a glass of beer, apart from being a bad pourer?
Well, again, some folks in France have decided to answer the question, which is oft asked, I'm sure, how many bubbles are in your beer? And again, long story short, but anywhere between 200,000 and 2 million is what they think.
Before they go flat.
Yes, indeed. And they've had some experience in this, because they've also asked the same question of champagne, because they do come from the University of Rheims, which is right in the middle of the Champagne region. And they reckon that in a glass of champagne, you've got about 1 million bubbles. And the important thing is, if you pour it down the middle, if you just sort of plop it down the middle, you get about a million bubbles. If you pour it carefully down the side, you get tens of thousands of more bubbles. And that is actually quite important, because supposedly the bubbles can interact with our taste senses.
You're making me thirsty, Alan.
I know, and and that makes a difference to the
taste. A good pour is a real thing, is the moral of the story. Alan Blackman, thanks very much.